This is Tuesday, June 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, the United States says Syria is gearing up for another chemical attack and threatens retaliation. We'll talk with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb about that. The Trump travel ban, whittled down by the Supreme Court, means more strict preparations for those looking to come to the U.S.
Well, I think they should bring to their visa interviews every scrap of documentation they have that shows what their relationship to the United States is.
Also ahead, we examine a new way to promote good nutrition for the young. That and more, all on today's International Edition. Monday, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said the United States had identified potential preparations for a chemical attack, similar to the attack in April in northern Syria that prompted U.S. airstrikes in response. Spicer warned Syria if its forces carry out another chemical attack, it will pay a heavy price. Syrian officials have denied the allegations. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, wrote on Twitter that any further attacks against Syrian civilians will also be blamed on Russia and Iran, who support Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Joining us on International Edition from the Pentagon is VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, thanks for being with us. Has the U.S. Defense Department had anything to say about this?
Well, yes. Navy Captain Jeff Davis, he's the Pentagon spokesperson, he has said that the information gathered by the military officials emerged over the last few days but became more compelling in the last 24 hours or so. I was speaking to another Pentagon spokesperson, Major Adrian Rankin Galloway, and he told me that this chemical attack prep was all going on at Shariat Airfield. You mentioned that attack in April. This is where the United States targeted, because this is the same exact airfield that was used to launch a chemical attack back in April that killed more than 80 people. So I think that people in the White House were trying to get out ahead of this to make sure the chemical weapons were not used. But the Pentagon is prepared for all this. They said that they've been aware and that they're looking into the details. It's very hard to get details from the Pentagon because it's classified information. But as I understand it, there was some activity with aircraft in one specific hangar that houses the chemical weapons. And because of that happening over the last couple of days, that's what sounded the alarms.
Have you heard of any particular preparations for any U.S. such counterattack on Syria, or is that just too classified for them to come out with anything?
Well, the Pentagon spokesman would not talk about specific suggestions over the last few days, but he did stress that the military is a planning center and a planning hub, and that the Pentagon always has military options for the President of the United States.
Well, I don't know whether you've been able to ask this question, and even if you have, whether you've gotten an answer, because Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., as we just mentioned, said the White House warning was meant for a wider audience. She told a House panel today that the goal is at this point not just to send Assad a message, but to send Russia and Iran a message. VOA talked with some analysts today who say they fear that with the recent shooting down of a Syrian jet and a Russian threat to treat planes from a U.S.-led coalition as hostile, that another retaliatory strike such as the one a few months ago could be a much more serious danger. Any talk about that whatsoever?
Well, yes. I asked, were there Russians on this base? Because there were Russians on the base back in April. And I was told by officials that, yes, there is still Russian presence on this base. The last time the U.S. struck this base after a chemical weapons attack, they avoided the places where the Russians were staying. They also avoided the runways because they did not want to do anything to hinder Russian activity. What they targeted were the Syrian aircraft and the hangars that housed the Syrian aircraft that could carry those chemical weapons. They did not touch the hangar that was thought to have the chemical weapons, because should they explode, that puts potential, I mean, there's lots of different things. It could be sarin. They wouldn't get into the details, but that puts all those chemical weapons in the air. They could harm everybody in the vicinity. So that is definitely something the United States is taking into consideration. But at the same time, the United States doesn't want to give the Syrians a pass if they are acting with chemical weapons. So I'm sure that there's going to be communication between the Russians and the United States telling them, hey, Syria does not need to use these chemical weapons because we are going to attack. And I know that the last time that the United States did attack, there was a warning with the Russians. This time, of course, maybe this is the warning that the Russians are getting. We just don't know yet until something happens.
Delivered in kind of a unique way publicly by Sean Spicer, the presidential spokesman yesterday. Can you remember anything like that ever happening before?
This is definitely a unique experience, but we are living in unique times here in Washington and here at the Pentagon.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. As always, Carla, thanks so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Thanks.
Let's move on to another story now, and it again involves President Donald Trump. He's renewed his attacks on the credibility of several major U.S. news organizations after the resignation of three CNN journalists who were involved in a retracted story related to Russia. Trump posted a series of tweets today criticizing the media outlets after CNN retracted a story connecting Trump associate Anthony Scaramucci and the head of an investment fund managed by a bank in controlled by the Russian government. The CNN story was published on the company's website Thursday, only to be removed Friday night. Andrew Palshevsky, our social media editor, one would think that would be fodder for social media.
You know, fake news has been one of those terms that we've seen in social media really since the Trump campaign began, and it has continued throughout his presidency, these calls that the media is fake, that the news is corrupt. This instance is one of two that's giving those phrases some resonance and giving some support to that for these Trump supporters. So we're seeing this CNN story getting a lot of attention on social media, and we're seeing another story, hashtag American Pravda. Now, this is a report released by a group called Project Veritas. What they've done in the past is they've tried to do these kind of gotcha behind-the-scenes or undercover videos. And in this instance, they have an undercover video where they talk to a CNN producer who says that a lot of the Russia stories about President Trump aren't substantive, that they're just being used for ratings. So this is the other story that's causing a lot of these fake news claims to pop up on social media. Now, people are saying that Project Veritas in the past has had a lot of questions about their methods and about how they put together their videos. There's been some accusations that they selectively edit to pick out just the parts that they want to show. So it's not real journalism. It's more of a partisan bent to it.
Or just trying to get more hits online.
I mean, it was trending all through social media earlier today as people were talking about this, especially, again, those Trump supporters saying this is evidence of fake news. But not clear how accurate this video is, but they're making the claim that CNN is only hyping these Russia stories for ratings.
I know you've been delving into serious stories for weeks now. Anything not so serious, or you just haven't seen them yet so far today?
It's, as I was telling you earlier, it's feast or famine. There are days when it's slow, and there are days when there are tons of serious news stories, and today is the latter, because the other big story today is hashtag Petya. It's a cyber attack, malware attack spreading from Ukraine across the world, and a very serious one. It's affecting U.S. drug maker Merck, the shipping company Maersk, other companies in Ukraine and around the world. There's one picture going around social media of a supermarket in Ukraine where all the checkout terminals, all the computers are infected with this ransomware attack. It's very similar to the WannaCry attack that happened last month where people saw that their files were locked. They had to pay up in order to get those. Of course, that attack last month was proved to have some workarounds and some holes that people could get through. Not clear about this attack, if you can do that yet. Also not clear exactly how this is spreading. Usually it's by people clicking on links that appear to be regular links and end up being this ransomware. But lots of attention on this Petya attack and wondering how far is it going to spread. That WannaCry attack had quite a lot of damage around the world, shut down a lot of computer systems, and that's the fear with this one as well.
You wonder, in about 30 seconds we have left, what can be done about this? Anything? Because whatever anybody does to try to prevent it, somebody comes up with the next step to override it, right?
Well, you remember with the WannaCry attack, it was actually a 21 or 22-year-old amateur hacker that found the loophole to get around that attack. So hopefully we'll find a way to get around this attack. But, the same things always apply. Don't click on links if they look suspicious. If you do get infected with this, unplug your computer, disconnect it from the internet. Unfortunately, until they come out with a patch or some kind of fix, it's just got to be careful out there.
Andrew Palshevsky on social media. How do they get in touch with you quickly?
You can find me on Twitter at APAL, APAL.
This is International Edition. Among the stories in the world today, the U.S. has detected potential preparations for a chemical attack at the Syrian airfield used in April to launch a chemical attack that killed more than 80 people. The U.S. has declared China as among the world's worst offenders in human trafficking and forced labor. EU antitrust regulators have fined Google $2.7 billion for unfairly boosting search results for its online shopping service. Ukraine, as Andrew just told you, has been hit by what its prime minister called an unprecedented cyber attack. And the Iranian foreign minister denounces the U.S. Supreme Court's partial reinstatement of a travel ban and saying the decision could energize terrorist groups. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website, on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA is getting set for the 2018 launch of the Parker Solar Probe, a spacecraft that will fly within 6.2 million kilometers of the sun's surface. The spacecraft and most of its mission instruments will be protected by an advanced thermal protection system. But to keep the two solar arrays that will power the spacecraft operating in the inferno-like surroundings, scientists at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory had to develop a special cooling system. The system's coolant is regular, pressurized, and deionized water. According to the Johns Hopkins team, this special cooling system has a heated tank that will hold and keep the water from freezing during launch, two speed pumps, and four aluminum-finned radiators made of corrosion-free titanium tubes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Supreme Court's decision to partially reinstate President Trump's temporary travel ban leaves the effort to keep some foreigners out of the country in somewhat of a murky middle ground, with lingering questions and possibly more cumbersome litigation. A full hearing on the issue is set for October. For now, the administration can bar travelers from six majority Muslim countries if they cannot show a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with someone or some entity in the country. It is unclear what will ultimately constitute a bona fide relationship, though the ruling suggested that an American job, school enrollment, or even a close relative could meet that threshold. The fate of refugees who often don't have relatives or jobs waiting for them in the U.S. also hangs in the balance. Joining us on International Edition is Stephen Yale Lair, professor of immigration law practice at Cornell University Law School. Professor, thanks for being with us. How are these new boundaries for immigrants going to be implemented, if they can be implemented at all?
We really don't know. The Supreme Court order gave a few examples of what the court thought would constitute a bona fide relationship, but obviously everyone's facts are slightly different. The Justice Department and the State Department said it would come out with some guidance for consular officers to help them identify what is and what is not a bona fide relationship. But even then, a lot will have to be left up to the discretion of consular officers and to immigration inspectors at the border. So we really don't know how they're going to interpret it, and I suspect it's going to cause confusion and more litigation.
Well, more litigation. This has already been ruled by the Supreme Court. So you mean starting new cases and working their ways through appellate courts that could take a long time, right?
Absolutely. For example, if an employer has sponsored a worker, but the worker is denied entry to the United States, the company may have to sue in federal court to say, well, that was an erroneous decision, and our worker really does have a bona fide relationship with the United States because we filed a petition on his behalf. And then a federal court would have to rule on that, and then it might go up to the appeals court. So it's certainly going to be cumbersome for companies and universities and family members to do that, but that may be the only way they get their loved ones or their employees or their students into the United States.
Well, one way that I've read about this morning so far is that somebody can just say, well, I've been working through this NGO, this non-government organization, and that could be enough. Is that correct?
Well, certainly some people would like to claim that's enough of a relationship, but I can see the government saying that's not enough of a relationship. The Supreme Court said explicitly that a nonprofit group cannot just contact foreign nationals overseas and add them to their client lists and then claim that they have an injury if they're excluded. So, you know, where the dividing line is between something that's too tenuous and one that is strong enough remains to be seen.
As you might know, this broadcast goes around the world, and we would think that quite a few people in these affected countries are planning or are hoping to get to the United States. How do they enhance their chances of making it here?
Well, I think they should bring to their visa interviews every scrap of documentation they have that shows what their relationship to the United States is. So, for example, if they're coming to the United States for a wedding, I would think that they would want to show, you know, documentation about the wedding invitation and their travel plans and where they're staying and a letter from the bride and groom indicating, you know, we're looking forward to having you participate in our wedding. If it's a university, obviously the student should submit the acceptance letter from the university or maybe the financial aid package that they received. If it's a company trying to bring in an employee, then the employee wants to bring the offer letter from the company as well as the approved petition. As much information as possible will help to the consular officer and the people at the borders to determine whether the individual has a bona fide relationship to someone or something in the United States.
As we all know, President Trump tweeted about the Supreme Court decision saying, "Great day for America's future security and safety, courtesy of the U.S. Supreme Court." Do you think the current setup accomplishes that?
It depends what you mean by safety. Obviously, no one wants terrorists to come into the United States. But safety also means enhancing the United States in a variety of ways, whether it's culturally or economically or just through exchange. And to the extent that individuals can no longer come into the United States for one of those purposes, then this actually hurts the United States in the long run.
Stephen Yale Lehr, professor of immigration law practice at Cornell University Law School in Ithaca, New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Doctors encourage their patients to eat a healthful diet. They often give them tips on how to do that, but a pediatrician in Spotsylvania, Virginia, is doing even more than that. Dr. Namali Fernando is showing her young patients and their parents how to eat healthy by offering them a variety of cooking classes, from baby food for parents to cooking with preschoolers and older kids. As Faiza Al-Masri tells us, Fernando's goal is to help kids establish good eating habits and inspire families to prepare nutritious meals with the ingredients they have in hand. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Hello, how are you, Miss Sally? Are you here for your checkup?
Namali Fernando has seen firsthand the connection between what kids eat and their well-being.
You know, on first glance, you think of diet-related illness as mainly just pediatric obesity. And it's true that about 30% of kids in our community and nationwide really are either overweight or obese. And that's a pretty staggering number. But as I paid more attention to a lot of the symptomatology that I was seeing in kids who even weren't obese or overweight, I was seeing that those symptoms often traced back in some way to the diet.
To help change that, the pediatrician co-authored a book, Raising a Healthy, Happy Eater, a parent's handbook. She also started a blog and a website.
I simply posted recipes on that website, and when I would see patients in the office and felt like I didn't have enough time to go over nutrition topics with them, I would point them to that website.
In 2012, she went a step further, co-founding the Dr. Yum Project. She developed a curriculum that preschool teachers can use to introduce nutrition lessons in their classrooms. And in the kitchen that shares space with the exam rooms of her doctor's office, she leads cooking classes. Her young patients, their parents, and members of the community are invited to cook with Fernando and her team.
One of my favorite recipes when my babies were little is roasting a sweet potato. Maybe it's using our menu planner to see how they can make meal planning easy for them. Maybe it's using our budget-friendly recipes to figure out how to eat really healthy on a budget. Maybe it's using our baby food options so that they can see how to feed their babies the same food as they're eating.
A little bit of breast milk or a little water, a little juice from the pan even.
Yara Esquivel, a working mother of two, has been taking cooking classes with Dr. Yum for more than 3 years.
Even my husband and I are eating better because we're making sure that the kids eat better.
Almost all of the ingredients used in the cooking classes come from the clinic's garden. Dr. Yum's co-founder, Heidi DiEugenio, says all the recipes are taste-tested and posted online.
Every single recipe is taste-tested by families, and we give the real feedback that we get from families, parents and kids, about the foods that are in there.
The ultimate goal of this project is to change the culture around kids' food.
There's a lot going on in the media and, you know, just kind of advertising and things around that say that kids, you know, kids' foods are like Lunchables or kids' foods are processed foods and kids won't eat fresh carrot sticks, they'd rather have Doritos. You have to remember that those messages are out there because those companies are trying to make money.
The Dr. Yum team hopes to inspire pediatricians around the country to start cooking lessons to help families enjoy real nutritious meals. For writer Faisal Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This has been International Edition. Find us at voanews.com, Facebook at VOA Now, Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks to Director Patrice Martin, our engineer Charleston Mock. I'm Ira Melman. That's my name. Have a good day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To address the economic, security, and governance issues facing the countries of the Northern Triangle, the United States and Mexico co-hosted in mid-June a high-level conference on prosperity and security in Central America. The Trump administration's top security priority in the Western Hemisphere is stopping transnational criminal organizations from harming American communities through the drug trade and its attendant violence, said Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Promoting prosperity in Central America is a key component of this effort, as our prosperity and security interests are tightly linked to the movement of ideas, people, and goods, he said.
What happens in the Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala directly affects the security and economic interest of the United States and other countries in the region. A more prosperous, safer Central America will do much to halt illegal and dangerous migration, defeat transnational drug cartels and gangs, and end corruption in their economies.
In order to boost economic prosperity, it is imperative that we work together to strengthen the formal economy and diminish the economic drivers of illegal migration and other illicit activities, said Secretary of State Tillerson. For that reason, the United States pledged to support regional governments in combating organized crime, enhancing citizen security, improving the secure flow of goods and people, increasing transparency, and promoting regional security cooperation. The United States will also continue its support for the Alliance for Prosperity and its efforts to address the economic, security, and governance challenges in the region. Since the launch of the Alliance for Prosperity nearly 3 years ago, the United States has allocated $1.3 billion to Central America. Indeed, the United States is committed to continue to improve the delivery of U.S. foreign assistance to the region. A secure and prosperous Central America contributes to a safer, more prosperous United States and Western Hemisphere, said Secretary of State Tillerson. The United States recognizes the region as an important area in our foreign policy agenda, and we welcome this opportunity today to work together to create the prosperity we all want and start solving the problems that are obstacles.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.